After its world premiere in London and a run in Washington, D.C., the Royal Shakespeare Company's new translation of Euripides' Hecuba has finally made its way here for a two-week engagement at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It runs from the 17th through the 26th, and joining me now are Tony Harrison, Hecuba's adapter translator, and for all intents and purposes, its director, and Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Hecuba. I'm very pleased to have them both with me today on the show. Hello.
Hello.
And Vanessa, welcome back.
Thank you.
The last time you were playing somebody, I think you were playing Virginia Woolf, weren't you, the last time we talked?
Or was it Mary Tyrone? I can't remember which time it was.
But, Tony, you're billed here as the developer of U.S. Productions. Is that a weird way of saying director?
Nice. It's a weird job description. Yes, it's a long history, which I don't really want to bore people with, about, I should say, a dysfunctional director. I mean, I'm used to directing my own pieces, but that wasn't my brief for this. I just did the translation, but I could see that I needed to be sucked in further and further, and that's what happened.
Well, let's talk about the play itself. When did Euripides write Hecuba? Is this one of his early plays?
It's about 423 BC, and he dealt with the same subject matter again in the Trojan Women in 415.
Now, what was going on in Athens at
the
time?
Well, they were in what proved to be a very disastrous war, the Peloponnesian War with Sparta, so that the use of stories from the Trojan War were always seen as a way of dealing with contemporary issues, too.
Well, in this case, we're talking about the audience seeing itself as the oppressor. Was he being critical of what was going on?
Oh, yes, he was noted for his critical attitude to Athenian democracy.
And so he was kind of a Bertolt Brecht of the time?
You could say that. He's nearer to Brecht than to another dramatist. He makes people think in the same way as Brecht does, and certainly the Hecuba play does.
Vanessa, when the play begins, Hecuba has lost everything. Her title, her husband, her son. She's about to lose her daughter and another son. And she, as Tony has put it, is the archetype of suffering. How does one approach playing the archetype of suffering?
Well, you can't play an archetype. With the help of the text and the extraordinary assistance of Tony and his assistant director, Chantal, we turn to the questions that Euripides is raising, either via Hecuba herself, who raises a lot of the questions, but also in many other ways. So I had to address the main thing, which is it's Hecuba is desperate to get justice, and her first plea to one of the Greek coalition leaders, Odysseus, who's come to take away her daughter as a human sacrifice, which the Greeks did not do human sacrifice. It was an act of utter barbarism in those times. She asks him on the basis of law. She says, "You Greeks, you have a law on shedding blood, and it applies to free men and to slaves alike." She's denied justice, legal justice, by Odysseus, and she later appeals to Agamemnon, one of the other coalition leaders, and asks for a just retribution. The words, I think, are very significant. She doesn't ask him to go out and kill the king who's murdered her son for money, for gold. Not oil, but gold. She asks for just retribution, and she has an extraordinary speech in which she says, if we let ruthless people trash the law, and we don't punish those who kill their guests and violate the holy places, there's no safe center in the lives of men. She poses that again. Agamemnon refuses her in a rather extraordinary way. He says, I will not help. But he agrees when she says, all right, don't help me, but don't do anything to stop me. And by the end, she herself, who longed for justice and fought for justice, commits an act of barbarism herself.
Well, in a way, it's similar to what happens in Medea, but there are big differences. She has tried to go through the legal system, in effect, and also she's in much worse shape than Medea, isn't she? She was a queen, and now she's a slave.
Well, you must ask Tony about that. Yeah. I don't really see connections with Medea.
Well, only in that somebody
except Medea was a foreigner, and she then gets her vengeance.
It's a much more domestic problem. Medea is a domestic drama. I mean, you can see some of Euripides' preoccupations in both plays, but Hecuba is much more a question of what one culture does to another in war and enslavement. It's not like Medea, which is someone who marries a foreigner and brings her to live in his own city. So it's a much more strongly public question that haunts Hecuba.
At the start, empathy is easily won. We empathize with Hecuba over her disastrous losses, but then doesn't empathy become a more complicated issue for the audience when we find ourselves rooting for her to take revenge?
It does, and Euripides uses also the chorus to make the audience cheer on Hecuba, that they really want to subscribe to her vengeance, and we all do. And the way the whole players work to this point, and the chorus use her vengeance almost as a substitute for all their revenge. They've all lost their children, their husbands, their brothers, and so this vengeance becomes a symbolic act for all of them, and so we're all wanting this act of retribution. And then when we see what happens, we think, oh, I don't think we quite signed on for the whole of this.
Agamemnon says, I think the wish is common among men as individuals and as citizens that bad men should suffer and good men thrive. So he is expressing a feeling that we all have, but then things can get out of hand. And I suspect that you were thinking about current events when you got involved with redoing this play. Is that the case? I mean, it takes a while to translate a play like this.
It takes a while to translate it, and I worked very carefully from the Greek, as I always do. And I think the only way, I tried first of all to do, which is something I also do in my poetry and the other work I do for the theatre or film, is to use very strong classical metrical forms with very colloquial, clear language, which is also what Euripides did. We know that Euripides was more colloquial than the other ancient dramatists because some of the words are found in that are found in his tragedies are found in comedies.
And he wrote in verse?
Oh, sure, verse. And it would be, the choruses would be sung, and this was, I think it was a wonderful, I've always been drawn to Greek drama because it seems to be one of the great models, the great forms for addressing really difficult, horrific issues. It's always been the great inspiration for me. And for example, you find the word coalition used. Well, the coalition is a very contemporary word, but it was also a word that describes accurately what the Greek force that destroyed Troy was. It wasn't Greece, it was a coalition of Argos, Athens, Sparta, Ithaca. That's how they thought of themselves.
My guests are Tony Harrison, who has adapted, translated, and directed a new production of Euripides' Hecuba, and Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Hecuba. The play will be performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music from the 17th through the 26th. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.com. org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Vanessa, have you done much? Have you done many of the Greek classics?
No, I haven't. I played Aphrodite long ago in Euripides' Hippolytus. She has one small scene at the very beginning of the play. And, I was very thrilled to be invited to be in the play. It's at the very start of my work as an actress. I don't think I really appreciated it. I was glad of a job that seemed to be an honourable job, you know, a Euripides play.
But you're
but
the kind of actor who
I did
really
a film with Kakoyanis, but of the Trojan women, and I played Andromache, and Catherine Hepburn played Hecuba. But film is film. It's completely different. So I would say, although I have done that work and read a great deal and so on over the past, really I felt I was starting from a new place. One, because it was Tony's translation.
Which is
and
a new
two,
translation.
Because the times we're living in, because Hecuba's whole story is a passionate, desperate search for justice. And millions of people are trying to get justice in many, many ways all over the world. And we're seeing at the present time, speaking of our own government led by Mr. Blair and your United States administration led by President Bush, an absolute assault on law. On law in such a way that affects the lives of every single American, European, every single citizen, all over the globe. An absolute onslaught on law and a breaking of law, which is very deeply, deeply alarming. And one of the wonderful things is that a number of judges, American and British, some of the best judges that we are respected not only in rank but in terms of their work, and American lawyers and British lawyers, a number of Europeans too. Gil Robles, of the who heads now the European Commission for Human Rights, are now in literally a battle, not a military battle, to defend these rights from being destroyed. For what purpose? In the name of ending terror.
Is that why this play looks very different than it did when it was produced in London? In London, it was in a pretty abstract setting. This play, this production makes obvious references to what's going on in Iraq.
It does. What I tried to do. I hated the abstract set. I thought it did.
The one we had in London.
The one we
yes.
had in London. I hated yes, the abstract set. I thought it was. It did a real disservice to the play.
Well, before we get to that, can I ask Vanessa? Does the set affect the way one performs?
Yes, otherwise there would be no such thing as stage design.
Mm-hmm. Tony
himself worked in his productions with, one doesn't always like to use the word the greatest, but to me she was the greatest
designer, yes.
English theatre designer, yes. Jocelyn Herbert.
And I learned all I know from, I worked with her for about 30 years on all the things I did, stage and film. But the new, what I see, it is a modern space that could be in a place which has had a recent war or is having a war, and there are a lot of tents, but it's a modern space haunted by an ancient play. That's the feeling I get from it. And it also has, in the curve of the tents, a feeling of an ancient Greek space that enfolds and encompasses the acting.
You mention in your introduction to the script that Hecuba has a history of being performed during wartime in the 20th century, in the same way that Lysistrata often brought out during wartime?
Sure. I in fact did them. I never realized the two, but I did not Hecuba, but the Trojan women. The Trojan women and Lysistrata were both written about the same year, about 415 BC, towards the end of this disastrous Peloponnesian War. So one was a comedy and one was a tragic look at war. And I put them both together. And it was a project for the National Theatre, which I finally didn't realise, because I'd set it all as in the women's peace camp at Greenham Common, outside the US base at Greenham Common, which was where there was a permanent camp of women, and it was the women of Greenham Common perform the Lysistrata and the Trojan women for the benefit of the guards behind the wire. And by the time the National Theatre had got the space for me to do it, of course Greenham Common had closed down, so it missed its opportunity. But it does, the Trojan women, more than Hecuba, has been done in times of war. It was done, as I say in the introduction, around the time of the Boer War in London, and it was considered very pro-Boer. Production was brought to New York in 1915 by Granville Barker.
Before the United States entered World War I.
Before the United States entered World War I, yes.
But Hecuba is one of the less performed of all the great Greek plays. Is that because it isn't as good a play as the Trojan Women?
No, it's not. It's as good a play as the Trojan Women. It's a wonderful play. I think that you have to have the right person to do it, and in this case we have the right person to do it, who's mm-hmm. born to play Hecuba. And that's the great thing, and that's the exciting thing for me, is that I when I knew Vanessa was going to do it, I immediately agreed to do the version, because I thought she was exactly the right person at the right time to do it.
Now, did you take the part because you thought, Vanessa, this was a great role, or because you also felt that it was important for Hecuba to be produced right now in the light of your political opinions?
Well, first of all, actually, when you have a peek at a role like this, my first reaction is, no, I can't do it. I will not be able to do it. It was my reaction when asked if I'd play Mary Tyrone in Long Day's Journey and Tonight.
Magnificently, by the way.
Oh, thank you. But no, because the play itself and the character itself place such demands on the chorus and the participants who act the roles, and indeed the director, the translator, that you don't easily say, hey, what a role. No, not at all. You say, oh my God, no, I don't think I'm up to this. But you see, Tony, the translation, and I felt, well, maybe if I get the right kind of help, I might be able to play this.
We also perform it in verse.
Actors aren't quite as confident as people might think.
Is performing in verse intimidating? Or Shakespeare, sometimes you just trust Shakespeare and the verse takes care of itself.
Well, no, poetry isn't intimidating, but it's demanding. And the poetry here, thank goodness, because it's Tony's poetry and Euripides' poetry, Tony's able to help me and all of us to get not only to the skin of the poetry, but through the skin to what's underneath, the thoughts that are underneath, what's Euripides is actually thinking. And poetry as such, I do countless poetry recitals because, like most people, I love poetry. I think Tony's poems are extraordinary, but that doesn't mean that Shakespeare's extraordinary, but that's a different kettle of fish, Shakespeare. There's a very interesting, if I was a scientist, I could describe it in quantum terms. Tony's language is, words are colloquial words, but they having said that, there are deep springs of events and thoughts that have formed these words. I know Virginia Woolf once wrote something which I thought was brilliant, that first she sees something in her mind and then it's like a wave and then the words begin to tumble forward. Well, that's Virginia Woolf. Tony would probably describe it in a different way. I'd love to hear you describe it, Tony. I have to be like a sensometer and still need help to do it. For the audience, it's fantastic because they understand what we're saying as long as we don't mess around with it.
It's also a wonderful device for bringing the ear into close-up, which is often with things that you would prefer maybe neither to see nor hear. And there is, within a verse medium, an ability to draw the ear in and keep it in close-up, if I can use that, of the ear. And also the basic meter, both of Greek and of English poetry, English dramatic poetry, is the iambus, da-dum. Da-dum, which is the beat of the heart.
Hmm.
And the heart occasionally misses a beat. The heart goes faster and slows down. You can, at some point, the scared Polixena, the daughter of Hecuba, is very frightened, but she has to make a brave decision. So you can feel her heart going at twice the speed of the verse that she has to speak. And so these kind of conflicts happen. Or the way the meter helps Vanessa's passionate speeches about justice. It's there to aid the momentum, aid the argument, give it force and focus.
I'm amazed because in Washington, the resonance is coming from the audience reaction, not only at the end but during the play, silences and then sudden murmurs of recognition as something is said, laughs also, and then at the end people calling out, "Thank you, thank you." It's like we're all in a chamber together. And we're all tuning in via Tony.
And just to pick up from that, because one of the things I also changed was the lighting, because we had the most appalling lighting in London. It was done in moody lighting and dark, half darkness. And I said right at the beginning, when we started this enterprise, that for the Greek imagination, one of the great things about the ancient Greek imagination was the worst the things that happen, the more light you put on them. And we must remember they were done in the light of day, where the audience saw the actor saw the audience saw each other, and that made it an act of common, shared language and experience.
My guests are Tony Harrison, who has adapted, translated, and directed a new production of Hecuba, Euripides' great play, and Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Hecuba. She'll be performing at the Brooklyn Academy of Music from the 17th through the 26th. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Vanessa Redgrave, who's playing Hecuba in a new production of Euripides' classic play that has been translated, adapted, and directed by Tony Harrison. He is also here. The production will run at BAM from the 17th through the 26th. Vanessa, you know that automatically when you say certain things about politics and about George Bush, there are going to be angry calls. And we have gotten a number of angry calls.
When? In the last couple of minutes?
Oh, yeah, when you said that before about an illegal war. I know you've... we do. You've started a new political party in England, haven't you?
Mm. Peace and Progress, yes.
How is that different from, let's say, the Greens?
The Guantanamo Human Rights Commission.
Because you feel that the Greens or some of the other opposition parties are not really getting the message out?
No, that's not where we're coming from. And I wouldn't have indeed joined any party because, as I'm a representative for UNICEF, basing ourselves on the Convention for the Rights of the Child, 1989, which the United States has still not signed, ratified. Clinton signed it, but not ratified.
Well, Congress refused.
Yeah, and a member, supporter, and so on of a number of Russian human rights organizations, Memorial and for Human Rights, and so on and so forth, Amnesty International member, etc. I couldn't possibly join and wouldn't wish to join a political party. This is a human rights party, precisely because my brother Corinne and I and a number of people felt that the issue of specific human rights had to be put at the top of the agenda during the election. And while voting for whichever good MP'd got a good record on the human rights questions, they might be a Green Party, a Liberal Democrat, they might be a Labour MP, nevertheless, there wasn't a party which is solely concerned with human rights and placing them and putting them forward. So we had three people stand, the leader of the Gypsy and Traveller community, they're known in Europe as the Roma people. In Britain, they like to call themselves the Gypsies and Travellers, Sylvia Dunn, who was Woman of the Year in 1999 in Britain, and Moazzem Beg, his father, Azmat Beg, who, for whom we did form the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission, and indeed were here in Washington, or there in Washington, March 2004, lobbying for the release back to Britain of both the UK citizens in Guantanamo and the British residents with British families who are still in prison in Guantanamo. So human rights is the issue. And
how well did you do at the polls?
I think we did very well, because again, the issue wasn't how many votes would we get. I think Mr. Begg got about 800 votes, but that wasn't the issue, nor was the issue the wonderful young man whose father we press conferenced with, who's been detained in Belmarsh under these infamous control orders, which the Commissioner for Human Rights of the European Commission has heavily criticized, that are being used by the Blair government on mere suspicion and without being charged and without a trial and without a defense lawyer able to see what the charges are. So we've had a big task. He did very well too. His family and people in the communities campaigned. And I think the point wasn't so much whether how many thousands, hundreds, or whatever of votes. The point was to raise the issue. No one was talking in the election about Guantanamo, Belmarsh, or the destruction of human rights and civil liberties.
I also want to let you know that another caller called in and said he's warmed by your comments and doesn't want you to think that everyone out there is disagreeing with you. But I wonder about what happens with the great Greek playwrights, because they pretty much were setting down all of the ideas that became theater ever since. There's a certain universality about them. Do they change? Does a play like Hecuba change every 25 years or so, depending on what's going on in the world?
I think that a play changes every time you do it, and certainly a play in an ancient language changes every time it's newly translated and newly performed. I believe you have to do... I've done, for example, Lysistrata of Aristophanes twice, a totally different translation. One I did just before the Civil War in Nigeria. I was living in Nigeria, and I took intimations of the coming Civil War to do a Lysistrata. Then I did, as I said before, a Lysistrata that was set in Greenham Common. So they do have that. Their ancientness gives them a flexibility that a more recent play perhaps doesn't have.
Of course, a translation is always as much the translator as it is the original work. How much have you adapted Euripides' play?
I always try to be very faithful to the plays I translate. I began to translate plays because as a poet, I always wanted to work in the theatre, but poets were not when I was young, were not welcome in the theatre because I think that T.S. Eliot had rather ruined verse drama, certainly for me.
What, Murder in the Cathedral? Was
Murder in the Cathedral was probably the best of his plays, but I mean the cocktail part in the family reunion, I couldn't stand them. I thought they were dreadful plays, and so did a lot of other people, and so that a poetic dramatist was not exactly welcome. And there might have been a different kind of drama in Britain if the First World War hadn't have happened, because Greek drama was being done. People are looking at Japanese drama. They're looking for alternatives to realism. And I've always looked for alternatives to what you can loosely call realism. And I wanted to be a poet in the theatre. That is not just be the person who writes the words, but the person who, as in an ancient Greek poet and dramatist would be, who was called the didaskalos, the teacher. He taught his work to the actors. He worked directly with the actors. All the great poetic dramatists worked directly with the actors. Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, Shakespeare, the Jacobeans, Goethe, Schiller, Moliere, Racine. And that's the sort of thing I wanted for myself. So I began by translating French classics, Greek classics from languages I knew, so that I could find a space for myself in theatre.
We see that a lot less these days, the writer also directing. Alan Ayckbourn is maybe the only British writer-director who comes to mind immediately. Edward Albee likes to direct the first versions of his plays, although he then hands them off to other directors later. How important is it to you, Vanessa, to work with the person who has written the text?
Oh, it's fantastic. It doesn't happen very often. This is the first poet I've worked with. Tony is the first poet I've worked with. I've been directed by in a production. I've worked with Martin Sherman, the American playwright, and he's been there through rehearsals. But they're plays that are written in prose. It is different, although there are not as extraordinary differences between prose and poetry as I think.
Well, Sally Potter recently made a film in which people speak in rhyme couplets, and
I did that a long time ago.
It takes a little while for you sometimes even figure it out if the lines are delivered in a very natural way.
I've made over 13 films, all in verse.
Really?
Yes. So.
Talking of verse, I was just thinking of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which, because I suppose of the deep concerns of the people who drafted and framed it, Eleanor Roosevelt being one, and because I was so struck, I wish you would play it on this radio station, because you have the original recording here in the New York radio and TV archives of a dramatized version of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
That was broadcast on WNYC?
It was broadcast in New York, and then an English version was done in London, and that's what hit me when I was a child. I didn't hear it till about 1949. It was broadcast here earlier. Van Heflin was and Charles Laughton were two of the actors who participated in it. And each article in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was first read out, and then there was a short scene which helped people understand what that article meant in its wonderful language. Wonderful because it expressed the most profound concerns and hopes of a generation following the fascism, the Holocaust, and the Second World War, and the defeat of fascism, that it should not happen again. And since I was a war child, it made the most enormous impact on me, because I felt that governments had certainly begun to seek for a way, and had certainly taken an enormous step in finding a way to make sure that the horrors that were perpetrated and the crimes that were committed by fascism and by Stalinism also should not be repeated.
Tony, this is a play about oppression of the weak by the powerful. Mm-hmm. Do you think it has a 20th century message?
Well, of course, it has a 20th century message. I've always I say to people that in my notebooks, my voluminous notebooks, of which I have hundreds that I doodle in, whether in my poetry or theatre or whatever, and I cut things out of the newspapers, and for years I've been cutting out pictures of women appealing to God or to the cameraman who's looking at it for, why have you allowed this to happen? And I've got hundreds of pictures from all over the world, and some very recent pictures from Iraq, for example. And I've always, over the years, even before I did the Trojan Women, though, thought of doing Hecuba, wrote Hecuba underneath them. And as I've said, she walks straight out of 2,500 years onto our front pages, onto our nightly newscasts. How do the powerless get justice? How do the powerless get retribution?
And this production...
Well, we usually say they have to have a trial. Mm-hmm. There have to be charges. There has to be a trial. There has to be a jury. There has to be prosecution. There has to be defense, lawyers. And there has to be cross-examination. And that nobody can be imprisoned, let alone tortured, without this happening. And indeed, this was why America made its revolution against Britain, wasn't it?
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. You can see this new production of Hecuba starting this Friday, the 17th. It runs through the 26th at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And my great thanks to Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Hecuba, and Tony Harrison, who has directed, adapted, and translated the play, for having been my guest today on the show. It's
been
a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
Thank you.